Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is David Boer. He's the writer of the comic book All New Firefly from Boom Publishing. It's based on the cult classic show Firefly. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Boer, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Definitely my pleasure. So I always like to start off my guest with a question about inspiration. So what inspired you to work on comic books, and who were your earliest influences?
Oh, that's such a loaded question. I don't know. I've told this story before, but I'm an attorney by training. I have now transitioned into full-time writing, so that's exciting. But my inspiration to sort of start into comics and start into writing more generally was kind of escapism. Because my first job out of law school was pretty intense, so I like to write creatively to sort of relax and sort of get away from the grind of it all. And that was probably 15 years ago now. And since that time, I started falling in love with comic books. I was not a comic book reader as a kid, other than things like Far Side and Mad Magazine I loved, but I wasn't a superhero kid much at all. So I try to stop myself from saying that I came to comics late, because I don't think there's a right time to come. So to imply that there's some lateness to it, but I did come as an adult. And reading Lock and Key by Joe Hill and Gabe Rodriguez was really my number one inspiration that showed me what comics was capable of as a medium and the stories that were possible. So that's where the inspiration came for comics.
Now, a lot of people, I think a general rule of thumb seems to be that comic book reading, something that starts off when they're a kid, you got to get them young and then, get them, get the fix in them, get in their blood and move on. So like you said, you came to it as an adult. So why and how did you suddenly decide that you wanted to explore comic books? I mean, because like I said, was there a particular spark that hit and said, this thing I saw maybe in a library or whatever, I'm going to jump in? What was that first like entry drug that you got into the industry with?
I mean, I had a little smattering of comics reading experience prior to, I want to say 2008, 2009. But reading Lock and Key was really what showed me how amazing comics can be. And since that time, I've sort of gone back and read all the read classics and read modern stuff. It's interesting, not being steeped in comics since I was a kid. It's interesting to see that play out, because I think there's a lot of lifelong comics readers who are really enamored with Marvel and DC and some of those characters because they've grown up and they've lived with those characters for so long. And as a newer comic reader, I come to them and I just sort of think, well, that's interesting, but I don't have that connection. There's plenty of stuff from my childhood that I am just head over heels in love with that other people are like, I don't know. but yeah, so I really, really, really gravitate toward much more indie, push the boundary comics that can show off the medium. I think right now there's so many comics being made right now and so many independent comics that we're seeing a lot of the same stories. They're different characters and of course different artists and that sort of thing, but they have all the same vibe to it, which is we're just getting another one of these. That's what I think when I read them. And every once in a while I'll pick up a comic. I'm really loving Vertigo, the 80s, 90s Vertigo right now.
Oh, yes.
It's just like such a different vibe, such a different tone, such a different way to tell stories, that I pick up comics now and I just think, oh, where is that? Where is that spark that makes me go, I love this? There's some Vertigo books that I'm I've read that. I just don't know the story. I just can't follow the story. I don't know. I couldn't tell you what it's about. But yeah. I love it because it's beautiful. It's poetry. Mm. It's interesting. It's a different way to tell stories. And I would love for us to get back to that. But that's my... I'll get down off my soapbox now.
I agree. I mean, one of the comic books that maybe changed the directory for me on how I go approach writing, especially comic books, is The Sandman. I mean, mm-hmm. talk about a comic book that... And I've said this before on my show, and I believe 100% that comes as close to any book I teach in English as being a true, absolute work of literature. Comic book, not comic book, is Sandman. It literally is a piece of art, of great writing and art. That book, it's amazing.
Yeah, and I have recently read most of the volumes, so I'm experiencing it for the first time in our present sort of. Structure of what comics is, and especially indie comics. And it just is so striking to me about how wide open Neil Gaiman felt the world was, that he could sort of play in that world.
Yes.
And not tell, the stories are linear, but it just takes time to get from point A to point B to point C. And maybe it's not until chapter 3 of a volume or chapter 4 of a volume of 8 chapters that you really see where the story is going. And I think that's okay. I think we are stuck in a cycle now where Hollywood wants comics, and so comics creators try to create for Hollywood. It's like, I don't need another story that's another sort of linear point A to point B. Take the first six to 10 pages of issue 1 to explain your premise. Like, I start with your characters.
Yeah.
You know, start with, introduce us to a character we love. And honestly, I don't care how complex your world is. I can find out new stuff in issue 3.
Yeah. But
I think there's a fear of doing that. And that's what I try to do with my stuff. I try to push it so that it's not necessary. It's more in that Sandman Vertigo mold than it is in, the present mindset, I guess.
You know, and I wonder if some of that has to do with the fact that you being new to comic books has a unique perspective on them. Because I think one thing that seems to have worried the big comic book companies, and kind of maybe filtered downwards, is the idea of continuity scare. You know, if you make too much stuff and too many story, people are going to freak out. So every story needs to be like 3 to 6 issues long. 3 to 6 issues. And then you move on to the next story. I mean, the idea that Neil Gaiman had Sandman go for 75 issues and kind of knew that's how many issues he was going to do it for, it's kind of seems like a very unique sense. Nowadays, it's, you know, your comic book is going to relaunch in 10 issues. You know, you're going to restart in 5 issues, you know, because that's considered the temperament of your reader. You know, 5 issues, move on to the next number one issue, you know? And I wonder,
yeah, and I think there's the reverse of that is, they only give you 5 issues. The publishers only give you 5 issues because there's so much content out there.
Mm.
And it's like, unless you blow the doors off right away, there's not going to be, an opportunity for growth to go a lot longer. Or if you're a super high profile, Brian K. Vaughan or Rick Remender or somebody like that, who can come in and pitch a 50 issue saga.
Yeah,
the little S saga, also the big S saga, right?
Yes.
So you can pitch a 50 issue story, and they know that you have the readers to come along with you. But comics creators who are right in the up and comers in the middle tier, you just have to constantly pump out new content, and I think that's as much dictated by readers as it is by publishers, because there's so much out there. Unless you create that romance with the readers right away, right out of the gate, they might hang with you for 5 issues, but they might be ready to move on to something else.
Yeah, it takes some serious balls as an indie person to determine, I'm going to write like a 30-40 page series. Like, well, you can try. you can definitely try, but once again, it's not easy.
I've told creators who come to me to their pitches are 10 for 10, 12 issues, and I cut it down to like 5, 6 at the outside, and even 4 to get it in the door, because you're not going to get 12 issues with, you know, one or two credits under your belt. You're not going to get 12 issues from a publisher for the most part. You're going to get 4, 5, maybe 6 issues, and then they're going to renew it. So like with my series Canto, we're up to issues, we're 21 issues in, but that was fully designed to be a long story, but it was also designed to be 6 issues that if it didn't work, those 6 issues would sort of live as they were. Mm. So we luckily have been able to continue on with it, but it's definitely structured in a way that we didn't go into IDW and say, we've got a 27, it's going to be 29 issues, I think, by the end of it. So we didn't go in by saying, we have 29 issues, come on for the ride.
Yeah.
And even with Canto, we restart every volume with an issue 1, because that really helps with momentum and sales. Mm. It's like if we started, issue 15 isn't going to sell anywhere close to even a new issue number 1 if you're on volume 4.
Right. Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, I do some indie writing on the side. I mean, obviously not IDW level, but, you know, some indie stuff. And yeah, I have to think in terms of 2 issues, 4 issues, maybe 6 issues. If I think the publisher's really that interested. And yeah, I mean, it's a crapshoot. Like I'm currently working on a sort of series that would be a long-term series, but do I really think it's going to make it through all how many issues I think it's going to be? Probably not. Am I writing it just because at the moment, because, you know, it's probably end up being Vanity Press anyway, probably. You know, I mean, it's rough. I mean, the industry, Indian comic book industry is rough. And, you know, to advertise it is hard. And social media has not made it any easier right now with new algorithms and that nature. It feels almost like a dice roll to figure out how to find your audience, how to keep that audience. And your audience has attention span of like 5 minutes. You know, if, you know, you delay right. too long, they're gone.
Yeah. And it's a game. It's a long-term game. It's a game mm-hmm. of strategy. Very few writers out there have their first, second, third, fourth works be Stranger Things or, you know, even I go back to Saga. I'm sure it was very popular when it first came out, but it was, I think the popularity has only increased over time. But the idea being that you're not going to establish yourself in the industry. It's very rare to establish yourself in the industry with, you know, 1 or 2 series, unless it taps into the zeitgeist and just becomes a massive, massive success. So it's a long-term game. Mm. So when you just got to keep putting out series. You got to keep putting out content. You got to keep writing, and you will step by step establish your audience. I've done series with IDW, Dark Horse, Image, and Boom, and only now am I establishing a core audience that I think it's an audience that will follow me and get my work because they like what I do. Not necessarily, it's not as much series focused, if that makes sense.
Mm.
Like they'll pick up, you know, my Image book, Rain, because they think Rain is cool. But now I'm starting to get to the point where I'm seeing people pick up Rain because it's one of mine.
Mm.
And they just come along for the ride. But that's, you know, I started writing comics in 2015 and my first series came out in 2017. So that's 5 years of working and putting out books. And only now am I starting to get to the point where I have readers that are with me for what I do, not necessarily just waiting to see if they're going to dig the next thing or if they just won't pick it up.
So as someone who, like I said, has been working this for 5 years and you're building momentum, you're building your fan base. How do you ride the wave, as it were? Because obviously there's a wave of, you know what I'm saying, putting out something
flailing.
New. Flailing.
Trying to keep my head above water, my friend.
So as far as that goes, I mean, once again, a lot of my guess, and I'm probably right on this, at least I think I am, but every single comic book reader is an indie comic book like Wisher. You know what I'm saying? Where they're in their head, they have this like imagination that I'm gonna write this issue, and it's gonna be huge, I'm gonna break into the industry, and everyone's gonna love my work, and I'm gonna be a genius. I mean, not every single comic book reader, but I get the feeling it's like it's in there somewhere nowadays that every reader's like, the next Kickstarter is gonna be mine. I'm gonna break through, you know? So, yeah. How do you handle that? I mean, not only the length of time, the patience. I'm sure you've had a lot of positive reviews. I'm sure you've had a few people who were like, what the hell, you know? I mean, how do you ride that? And over 5 years, I mean, that's a lot of patience, a lot of follow through, you know?
Yeah, you just have to, first off, is just have a thick skin, because there's people who aren't going to like your work. And second of all, you just have to keep going. You just have to keep writing. My first series was, I really loved, and it's landed very softly. And then my second series, which had a big a name attached to it, still did not do the things that I wanted it to do. So just keep going. Yeah, just kept going. And then Kanto came along, and I saw this character that Drew Zucker, my co-creator and the artist on Kanto, the character sketch that he had created, and we wanted to work together. And as soon as I saw it, I said, wow, this is the kind of comic that I would want to read. This is the kind of character I would want to follow. And I just, from that point on, just have followed my passion for telling the stories I want to tell. I do Killer Queens at Dark Horse is an LGBTQ space comedy. And Rain is a drama, a horror drama. Kanto is an all ages fantasy, all very different things. But one of the through line to all of them that I like to, tell folks is that it's my passion for telling those particular stories. I'm writing Firefly for Boom, and that's my favorite sci-fi franchise. So I want to tell the stories that I'm so passionate about telling it's going to carry me to the finish line. It's going to carry me over the finish line to finish the stories. And, there's going to come the day when somebody offers me up a job for something that I'm not super passionate about. And I just don't know what I would do in that circumstance, because it's so important to me to tell stories that I'm passionate about and I love and I want to get out there. So I think if you're a writer or an artist or a comic creator and you want to do indie comics, don't chase the things that you think will be. It's just, I've heard it a million times, and I found out on this end of it, it's absolutely right. Don't chase what you think is going to be successful, what's going to sell as a TV show, what's going to sell as a movie, what's going to be really popular. Chase the story you're passionate about telling, and I guarantee you that's going to be more successful than you trying to create some cool concept because you think people are going to dig it.
Mm. So when you're something like Kanto that you did have the opportunity to work on over time and develop as a series, how does that opportunity to and confidence to be able to write a series that, I'm going to do maybe these six issues, I'm going to do the next six or whatever. How does that help you develop as a writer, knowing or having the opportunity to write a long form comic book and develop a character over time, instead of, like I said, a lot of writers, as we talked about, you have 3 issues, 4 issues, then you're done. You got to pack everything you want to do, 4 issues, move on to the next title. Having the one title and be able to develop that over time, how has that made you a better writer?
Long form storytelling is very difficult, and I've only learned that through trial by fire. So, Kanto was, we envisioned the different story arcs that would go forward. So we had an idea of where everything was going with Kanto. To get the opportunity to tell that, once you get to like volume 2 and volume 3, I have a paragraph for what those 5 or 6 issues will be. So it's then breaking that out into 5 issues or 6 issues, figuring out the cliffhangers, all that stuff. And then projecting, remembering what's happened before and projecting what's happening in the future. So it's always good to have that end point in mind. And then Firefly is 11 issues that I'm writing. And that too, I spun out the story over the course of 11 issues, and it's kind of, evolved a little bit as I've been scripting it. But that too has been an interesting challenge to watch, to go from point A to point Z and hitting all the points in between, but finding out that the road that you charted in your outline isn't necessarily the road that you're going to take. So it's helped me as a writer take a longer view, a wider view of what's the story I want to tell. And I feel like when you're doing long form storytelling, as long as you know where you want to start, as long as you know where you want to end, and you know some of the stops in between, you're going to be all right. You're going to be able to write those interstitial spaces.
So in something that is long form, or especially some, or like Canto, where there's a gap between, I mean, it's long form, but there's a gap between series, do you ever worry that you're going to lose the voice of a character? Like, do you, is something you have to dig back in, or is something that just kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like, I've talked to a few people that, you know, you have to go back, or they'll watch, like, Firefly, they'll go watch the show again and get the voices back. And I think I talked to J.M. DeMatteis, he's like, no, they're all just all in my head. They come back. I was like, oh shit. Okay, maybe that's why you're better than me.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that is absolutely related to your passion for telling particular stories. I love Firefly so much that those characters live in my head rent-free. And they talk to each other. And I know when I'm reading a script, I know what Kaylee's gonna say to Mal. And I know the quips that Jane is going to throw in there when he's talking to Simon and River. I just know, I know these characters. Mm. So every time I go back to script, their voices are already there. They're in my head. They're talking to each other already. And I'm just sort of transcribing. Same thing with Canto. I know who he is as a character. I know what he would say. I know how I'd react to every situation. So coming back to him, it's like, okay, buddy, little buddy.
Yeah.
What do you want to do now? What's our next adventure together? And I don't really have that anxiety that I'm going to lose it. Now, if there's a long form story that I'm writing for a character that I haven't internalized in that way, I could see that's more of a challenge, but I think it only takes a couple of issues to really get the character's voice to be second nature as you're writing it.
So, I mean, I love Firefly as well. I must admit, I saw it after it aired live. So it was a few years later that I found it. People kept talking about it. I was like, all right, I'll check the show out. And I loved it. Which maybe it's one of the reasons why the show didn't last. People like me were like, I'll wait. You know, and then I was like, damn it. I should have watched it. Maybe it would have been canceled. But, well, one of obviously the controversies on the show are about surrounding Firefly a little bit was the movie Serenity, which I love personally, but obviously there were some people who were unhappy with what happened to some of the characters, some of the characters, or some feeling that maybe didn't quite feel like the TV show. It was a little bit different in there. When you're writing Firefly, how much in your head is like Serenity, the continuity, is that all connected to you? Is that, you know, this is directly out of the show? Is it a little bit, is it just a TV show that we're talking about, kind of ignoring a little bit what happened in the movie?
So there's 36 issues of Firefly after take place in the continuity after the movie. So all new Firefly that I'm writing takes place after issue 36. So it's all in the continuity. So the members of the Serenity crew that they've lost over time are gone. There's a couple new ones. It's all sort of the characters have evolved. So I liked the movie. I enjoyed the movie. I think the people who are critical of the movie, I would like to take a time machine back to 2006 or 7 or whenever the movie came out, maybe a little later. I'm sure somebody in the comments will correct us. But I would love to take a time machine back to when the movie came out and just talk to Firefly fans about it, because I think they would feel differently. Because Firefly as a show had a very short life, and you know, if it would have come out now, it would have probably gotten at least a second season. But since it was cut short, that movie, it was kind of a miracle that the movie even came to life, because that was Fox sort of saying, yeah, we'll throw you a bone. We see that there's some, you know, that there's fans who love this show, So we'll give you 2 hours to sort of wrap up the whole verse.
Yeah.
And what we did, you know, what you did in the show. And I think back then, most Firefly fans are thankful to be able to go back to the verse one more time. Nowadays, of course, you know, we're all Monday morning quarterbacks.
Yes.
Like, well, they should have done this. They should have done this. Yeah, it feels like a movie. It doesn't feel like the rough and tumble Old West of the TV show. But that's the nature of movies versus television. And, you know, I mean, back then especially, there was a separation.
I mean, they made some ballsy ass decisions in that movie. I mean, killing Wash. I mean, that's pretty damn ballsy. You know, I mean, it was like that. I mean, I saw it. This is going back some years ago. And I think I watched it with my father because he didn't know the movie. I got him to watch it because he hadn't watched the original TV show. It's like, well, so they killed off that guy. That probably sucks. I was like, yeah, he was one of the main characters. Like, what do you mean he was one of the main characters? Like, yeah, he was one of the top, the main crew. So he's like, Jesus Christ, they killed him off like that? I was like, yeah, they did.
And Buck is gone.
Look, and River turns into like the ass kicking, like super assassin. I was like that. I mean, that was some ballsy ass decisions they made.
It's true. But I like when characters. This is so terrible to say. I don't like when characters die, but I appreciate stories that are not afraid to kill off characters because it never makes the reader 100% comfortable about where the story is going to go. So I, you know, Wash was amazing. He was an amazing character. And there's ways to bring back Wash's sort of persona.
Yeah.
As you can see in the comic books, they've done a couple of different things that way. But there's ways to bring him, to keep him in the forefront, even though that really tragic, shocking moment in the movie. So I like that idea that we can never be 100% comfortable because we don't know it's like real life.
So that being said, since you said that, as the writer of Firefly, how afraid should the fans of Firefly be right now? you threw that out there.
Like I said, you know, you can never get complacent with your beloved characters. Because you never know what's going to happen to them.
Well, one thing about Firefly, once again, that it's a licensed property at Boom. I think it was before it was at Dark Horse, but you know, it's obviously owned by the Josh Whedon company and all that.
Disney and Fox.
Oh, Disney and Fox. It's not. Oh, wow. Okay. Because
Fox is at Disney now. So
oh, that's right. That's right.
It's Disney that actually owns Firefly and Buffy and Angel and.
Which is why they.
Whedonverse.
Which is why they talked about potentially bringing back Firefly with a new cast. I was like, oh god. Anyways, so
I have an idea for it. So,
oh really? Okay, cool. So you're gonna pitch it, but
I hope so. I mean, that would be amazing.
But being that it is a licensed property and you have the weight of Disney and Fox behind it, is there an editorial mandate in this book or things that they're telling you you can do, can't do, can't move in this direction? This character. Holy, can't screw with that character, or do you have basically the freedom to make your story?
I had so much freedom to write this story. The Firefly as a TV show movie is, you know, 15, 20 years old now. So they're not very precious about most any of it. So we have a lot of freedom to do. There's a couple of things that we just can't do visually. Just because they just don't, you know, Disney doesn't want, you know, that particular thing. But beyond that, I was allowed to play around in the verse and just tell the story that I really wanted to tell. And I think I got the opportunity to do that. So I'm really excited for folks to check it out. We've just started. Issue one just came out. Issue two is just coming out. And then, there's 11 issues. And I think the best... The last issue is a big oversized issue. And it's I just love what we've set up to pay off by the end. So I hope folks come along for the ride because I think you're going to be really satisfied with how the story plays out.
Yeah. And like I said, I really enjoyed the issue that you wrote. One thing that I thought was interesting and I think you did a great job with it is that when you're watching the Firefly TV show, and I mean the movie as well, Serenity, I mean, obviously the writing was great. I mean, I really love the Firefly, the writing. But one of the key points, the way the show works, is the chemistry among the cast. You know, the charisma they brought, the characters, you know, and the energy they brought to the screen. How easy is it to translate what the actors brought onto the screen and onto a printed page where you don't, you know, you're not getting the voice, not quite getting them, but you're still, you know, say obviously it's those characters. So how easy was it to bring that energy to those actors, the chemistry, to the printed page?
It's such a challenge to go from, you know, moving pictures to stationary pictures. But, you know, again, it goes back to knowing these characters and having internalized who they are. And of course, they're defined. Nathan Fillion has defined Mal Reynolds. So in my mind, it's Nathan Fillion walking around on Serenity and, you know, as Mal and Inara and Kaylee, and just it's all those actors. But knowing their voices makes it easy to create scenes where that banter can happen. That's one of the most, that was one of the great things about Firefly, is they've created characters. There's characters whose personality begets this fun, funny banter. And I think comedies, you know, and I say comedies, comedy in quotation marks, because more, you know, Marvel movies have a lot of comedy in it, in them now. And I love that. So they're not, I'm not calling Firefly a comedy per se, but the comedic part of Firefly is born out of who these characters are, not necessarily, you know, set up and punch in every scene.
Right, right.
And so I think that the comedies that work, the comedic moments that work, are organic to these characters, not just me or any other writer trying to inject funny into the story. And that was such a fun aspect of Firefly, was to find out what ridiculous things these characters would end up saying to each other.
Yeah.
Because you know it's there. It's just it's whether or not they open their mouth and say it.
Well, I think one of the surprising aspects of the book, and I think what readers may find surprising, if they have not read the other Firefly, I think it was Greg Pak who wrote that series and moved on and started with yours, is I think they'd be surprised to find that Kaylee's the captain of the ship. I mean, Mal's not dead. He's still around. But Katie's in charge.
There was a whole. It was interesting to read some of the commentary on All New Firefly number one, because I had read up till that point, and so it didn't really dawn on me that readers would want to jump on if All New Firefly number one, not having at least some basic, you know, exposure to what had happened previous to that. So people expressed surprise that Kaylee was the captain, and you know, Leonard was part of they're like, who is this guy Leonard, who's part of the crew and everything. I'm like, there's a whole story arc about how he came in, and you know, there's a whole part about Kaylee, and Mal was gone for a while and they brought him back, and he has this existential sort of crisis about being captain, and that's why he's not captain anymore. And it's all those wonderful things. It's like jumping into Firefly in season like 5 when you haven't seen the first 4 seasons. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't jump on with this, because the story arc, if you accept sort of everything as it's constituted without a lot of explanation as to why we are at that point, this story stands on its own. So if you are a Firefly fan but you haven't read everything up till you know, All New Firefly number one, that's okay. Come on board. You're going to enjoy the ride. You're going to enjoy the characters. Just know that there were 36 issues prior to this that got us from Serenity to, you know, Requiem, where they are now in All New Firefly number one.
Well, like I said, I mean, I think it was extremely well done in the first issue. I think the other thing people like about Firefly, that these are not, I mean, and I love Star Trek, but these are not Star Trek, where, you know, we represent the Federation, we're going out on a mission of peace, and we're full of goodness. The Firefly cast is like space pirates almost. You know?
Bandits.
Yeah.
They're bandits and outlaws, and they just don't, they're morally flexible, and you
right.
know, all that stuff. And I think that's what, it's like Star Trek exists in New York City and in the 19th century, and Firefly exists in the West.
Mm.
That's sort of how it is. So, and I like that.
So yeah, so when you're designing that storyline, right, you obviously have a group that, especially when you know the original TV show, is there's they have a certain type of morality. They go on missions. Sometimes the mission isn't exactly a moral, you know, isn't a moral proposition what they're doing, but often the morality sometimes takes over, sometimes it doesn't. So when you're dealing with characters that exist outside the law or are kind of somewhat criminal, how do you balance the idea of the mission and kind of pushing them so they're kind of doing things that are wrong, but not doing things that are considered immoral necessarily?
Yeah, so obviously they're out there, they're trying to survive, and they're going to do what they need to do to survive.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, they're always going to do, I think the Serenity crew, it's so good. The show's so good because, you know, they're good folks. They're always going to do what's right. They're going to give back the medication they were going to try to steal.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody else needs it more than they do. They're going to try to help. They're going to do those things because I think that's who they are as people. If they just did what was morally, if they just did what was necessary without a moral compass, they'd be reavers. They'd be true bandits, true outlaws, but they're not that. So I had a great time in this story arc towing the line between the two, because they have the opportunity to steal a bunch of stuff. And some of them are like, we're not stealing from these people. Other ones, you know, are like, the usual suspects are like, oh, but we could, you know how much we could get out in the verse for this stuff? So it's that constant tension. And the whole story arc, the overall, is about Jane. It's focused on Jane. There's a lot of other things that go on. But in Jane is a very morally complex person. He does a lot of bad stuff, and he's done a lot of bad stuff in his life, but you also see that he tries to do good, and just it never seems to work for him. So you can only do that so many times before you convince yourself that you don't need to be doing good anymore, because no good is going to come of it. So we'll see that moral conflict inside Jane, who is one of the most complex characters in all of Firefly. You may not believe that, but that's what I tried to do in the story arc, is to find out who Jane really is and what he would really do.
Well, the first issue that you wrote starts off with a backstory on Jane, as a kid. And they kind of, you're suggesting with him as a kid that there's an inherent goodness to Jane. That, because like I said, fans of the show know that, once again, there's many episodes where you're like, son of a bitch, you know, he kind of does a dick move. But because of showing that he is a kid, I mean, as a kid, are you suggesting, like I said, that he's inherently good, and then that goodness is gonna come out later, or is he just always complex?
It's more than just him being inherently good. His mom in that flashback in issue one says, "You're a good kid, Jane." I forget what the exact line is, but you just gotta. There's a good kid inside you or something. You just got to let him out or something like that. And that's something that Jane, for his entire life, has been hearing. It's like Mal has him on the crew because he's useful, but also because he would not have somebody on the crew he did not think he could trust at the end of the day. And he can trust Jane. I mean, it's, you know, questionable at times, but he can. I think ultimately, if you asked Mal, he would say yes, I have Jane on the ship because I trust him to do the right thing when it's necessary. But Jane himself, I don't think he sees himself as a good guy. I think he doesn't necessarily see himself as a bad guy. And I think he really gets annoyed when folks try to say he's good and folks try to say he's bad. He's like, he doesn't think he's any of that. And you're going to see that he's going to be thrust in a, pulled in both directions in this storyline of, is he good? Is he bad? Who does he think he is? And I think at the end of the day, that's the question that we need to answer. Who is Jane Cobb according to Jane Cobb?
Well, at least, I mean, obviously he's on the crew, so Mal does trust him. we do remember the episode where he almost got, almost sent him out of an airlock because he screwed over his crew a little bit. How concerned is Mal?
But the importance of that scene wasn't that Mal was going to throw him out of the airlock. I don't know if you remember. I've watched the scene so many times because I think it's a defining moment for Jane. And when Mal walks away, Jane says,
"Oh, don't tell the crew
what I did. Yeah. Make something up. And in that moment, Malcolm goes, there's something more to Jane Cobb, because even in the doorstep of being killed, being thrown out of the airlock, he doesn't want the crew to think bad of him. And that's why Mal lets him back into the ship. And that moment is so defining for their relationship and for Jane Cobb in particular. This is who he is. He's somebody who does bad stuff. He does good stuff. He wants people maybe not to think he's such a bad guy. But then again, every time he tries to do good stuff, it kind of backfires a little bit. So we're going to see all of that spin out in the story arc. I'm very passionate about this story.
No, I mean, like I said, they're great characters. Like, that's one of the reasons why some people who know good television enjoyed it. I haven't gone back and enjoyed watching it. I mean, some reason in my head, I don't know if this is a bad analogy, though, but an analogy in my head popped up was like sort of like a dog, almost. Like, I somebody compared Jane to a dog. That is like, yeah, it's basically a good dog, but if you leave food on the table, you walk away, the chance the dog's going to eat your food. I mean, just be careful. You know, trust the dog to a certain degree, but at the same time, the dog's going to do what it's going to do. Does Mal have a thought, even though he trusts Jane, that you still got it at all times? Is he thinking to himself, Jane could do something bad at this point? If I'm not careful, Jane could go the wrong way. Jane could got us into trouble. You know, because like I said, I mean, once I can't remember the episode, but you know what I'm talking about, where he reports the crew to the authorities because he can make some money on it. I mean, is that a thought that goes through Mal's head that, yes, he's a crew member. I think he may be trustworthy, but if I'm not careful, he'll bite me.
Yes, and I think if you really pressed Mal, he would say it's less about Jane truly turning on them, but Jane making some precipitous decisions that he doesn't think through.
Mm.
So, like turning them in, he thought that would be River and Simon. He thought that would be the easy way to sort of make himself safe and make some money off of them. And you see in that airlock when he's like, don't tell him what I did, you see him starting to think through and learn about the consequences to some of these decisions. And Jane is Jane, so he doesn't think more than a step. He's not a strategic thinker.
Yeah.
So I think that's what Mal is most worried about with Jane. It's that he'll make bad decisions that'll put the crew in danger, but not necessarily that Jane is this evil bandit who's going to turn on. There's a moment in the show when you see how Jane got on the crew and Mal offers him more money in a private bunk. And Jane immediately turns on the other folks who are with him. And so Mal knows if another offer is going to come, it comes along. Jane's not going to think through, well, am I safer on Serenity or am I safer with them? You know, a week from now, a month from now. He's just going to think, ooh, more money in a private room, a private bunk. And you're going to see the crew struggle with that very concept when dealing with Jane, especially Kaylee, who's captain now. And she's trying to like be captain for everybody on Serenity, including Jane.
Yeah.
She doesn't know how to be captain for somebody like Jane. So you see her struggle with that too.
Well, on the show, they developed, you know, obviously Malcolm and Jane, Jane has respect for Malcolm. And I mean, I respect and also maybe a little bit of fear as well, but of Malcolm, Captain Mal. But I can't remember the episode names anymore, but there's an episode where, what the hell's the name of the episode? Where they have to go on separate ships because the Serenity's dying. They have to separate and Jane goes with Inara and I think maybe Kaylee as well. And it goes in that direction. And Malcolm basically tells Inara, you know, if you let him take over the ship, he's going to. Because while Jane respects Malcolm, Mal at some point, he doesn't necessarily respect the others because he thinks, you know, he's the alpha male in his head, probably. With Kaylee in charge, does Jane respect Kaylee enough to view her as a captain? Or is it Mal's there on the ship, screw with Kaylee, screw with Mal? How does that, you know what I'm saying, that whole dynamic work?
Yeah, so he does respect the Kaylee's chain of command. He's more of a loose cannon, unpredictable, rather than specifically like alpha male now, because so much time has passed since the Serenity movie and since the show. So I think Jane has calmed down and he sort of understands the value. He understands that Serenity is a family and he's part of that. So I think he's accepted that, but he's still the same Jane that's making decisions without thinking them through. So he respects Kaylee, but Kaylee is still having to deal with that loose cannon aspect of Jane sort of doing his own thing. And sometimes he doesn't listen to her. And it's not that he doesn't respect her chain of command. He's just like, I think I have a better idea for this, or I'm not even thinking about that. And he just goes and he does some things. So I don't think she's got any sort of fear that he's going to turn on her and like revolt and take over the ship or anything like that. But it's more like, how do you keep Jane on the straight and narrow when Jane's never been on the straight and narrow?
Well, another interesting character change for those who may not have read Greg Pak's run is Zoe. She's a mother. How's that impact her as a character? And how dangerous is doing what she does with a kid on board? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's something that she has to now calculate.
Yeah, so I think she's much more hesitant about the things that they do and the jobs they take and that sort of thing. I think she's much more worried about, you'll see it start to play out in the story arc. I don't want to give too much away, but I think she's much more worried about some of the variables on the ship, like River. You know, now that she has Emma to take care of, I think she's worried. She's much more worried about the danger that's inside and outside the ship. And you see that play out with some of her more, she's much more cautious than she was when she and Mal were kind of in the Unification War. And then when they got on Serenity together, they're kind of like attached at the hip and they kind of, you know, shooting from the hip. And I think she's much more like, is this the best idea? Maybe we should just keep move on and find something else to do that's a little less dangerous.
So going forward, what can our listeners look forward to in future issues of All New Firefly?
Well, the story arc is called The Gospel According to Jane. So you're going to experience a lot of Jane kind of doing some boneheaded things and finding a way out of it. And also those moral dilemmas that that we were just talking about. The crew is going to find themselves in a big moral dilemma that's going to play itself out in how we value the past, how we look at the past, how we look at the present, and how we face the future.
Well, Mr. Brewer, Fireflies looks a fantastic series. The first issue is out. The second issue comes out probably within a few weeks. So when does the next one come out?
Actually, tomorrow. Oh. I don't know when this is going to air, but it's March 23rd.
March 23rd? All right.
Yep.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mr. Brewer, for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast. You're fantastic. And All New Firefly, it was a great read. I enjoyed reading the first issue. And I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Sure. And I just will quickly plug, I've got my series, Rain, is issue 3, just came out on the 16th, so a week ago, and that'll be 5 issues from Image Comics. That's an adaptation of a Joe Hill story. Firefly is coming out. Kanto is going to have a mini series starting in June. Ooh. And then the Kanto fourth arc is going to start in the fall. And then I've got a couple more things that are coming down the pike. So stay tuned, follow me on the socials, and I will be screaming from the rooftops. I promise. Thank you. Thank you very much.